Luke chapter 18, I'd like to read verses 13 and 14. But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself will be exalted. Just over a couple of years ago, the Observer magazine ran an article on the theme of guilt. They asked a number of different people for their experiences of what made them feel guilty. And it was an extraordinary well of emotion that they managed to uncover. People they found seemed to feel guilty about almost everything. There were some who felt guilty about their elderly parents. There was one who felt guilty about being a working mother. Another felt guilty about sending a child away to school. Those who felt guilty about divorce or infidelity, abortion, money, their work, AIDS. Indeed, the front cover of the magazine was emblazoned with the one word, guilt, across it. And just underneath it, it said, you name it, we have it. It seemed that everybody was guilty about something. And it does seem that guilt is one of the basic human emotions. From the cradle to the grave, many of us carry with us huge burdens of guilt. We may not admit it, and we probably wouldn't want to talk about it, but all too often it is there. The Romanian pastor Richard Wurmbrand spent, I think it's 14 years of his life, in a communist prison. And he spoke of how so often in prison things came back to people's mind that they remembered from their childhood, guilty memories. And he said this, old betrayals and dishonesties returned with inescapable persistence. It was as if they came into your cell and looked at you in reproach. Mother, father, girls long ago abandoned, friends slandered or cheated of their due. And all began when I was a boy or when I was at school. The memory of old transgressions stood like savage watchdogs before the sanctuary of God's peace. We may not know the experience of prison, but many, if not all of us, could echo those emotions of remorse, regret, and guilt. We all know what it is to feel guilty. Now, for some years, I was the proud owner of a large black dog called Charlie. And like many dogs, he had an extraordinary ability to look guilty. Usually he had every reason to. But actually, it's what makes dogs in some ways so attractive that they seem almost human. In fact, in my kitchen, I've got a poster up of a little puppy which says, I'm really innocent, I only look guilty. And it's certainly what I find dogs so preferable to cats. In fact, it's one of the many reasons that I do. But somehow they seem to be human in their expression of guilt. And we've all felt guilty. In fact, many of us at the moment probably feel guilty. And it is an extraordinarily powerful emotion. It causes us to do extraordinary things, either to cover it up or also to try and atone for it. Indeed, sometimes people seem to spend the whole of their lives trying to atone for something that they've done earlier and for which they feel very guilty. Of course, as I say, we do try to cover it up. We often hope that nobody will find out. I rather like the comment of H.L. Mencken, the famous American critic who once said, self-respect is that secure feeling that no one, as yet, is suspicious. There's always the fear, isn't there, that someday we're going to get found out. We hope nobody does, and yet even if they don't, it doesn't necessarily help us, does it? Because it sort of increases the feeling of deception, that we're kidding other people. And I really want to ask this question tonight. If guilt is a universal human emotion, if it is something we all share, what do we do about it? And what particularly does the Christian gospel have to say to it? And to answer those questions, I want us to turn to this story that Jesus told in Luke chapter 18. It's the story of two men. One of them was a Pharisee, moral, upright, respected, religious, the sort of person you'd want probably as a father or a brother or as a son, the sort of person who knew it, knew that he was respected and was proud of it. But on the other hand, there was this tax collector. He was dishonest. He was a collaborator with a hated occupying force. He was despised and he was very far from being religious. And he also knew it as well and was bitterly ashamed. And they both went to the temple to pray. They both wanted to find God. But only one of them succeeded. And it was not the one that we would expect. You see, the trouble was that both of them were guilty before God. But only one of them would admit it. The tax collector. It's fairly obvious what he was guilty of. Everybody knew it. He knew it only too well himself. But the Pharisee was also guilty. And he was guilty of something, in a sense, much more insidious. He was guilty of pride. And because of his pride, he was never able to see it. And because he couldn't see it, and because he couldn't admit it, because he never thought that he was guilty, he never therefore knew the love and the forgiveness of God. You see, one felt guilty, and the other didn't. And yet both of them were guilty. Both of them fell short of God's standards. Both of them, as the Bible would call it, were sinful. You see, guilt is actually a fact. It's not a feeling. And guilty is not something that we feel. It is something that we are. And the Bible makes very clear that each one of us is actually guilty before God, whether we feel it or not. So how do we handle it? What do we do with this guilt, whether we feel it or not? I want to say that there are, I think, three ways of dealing with it. And the first way is to reject it. Reject it. That is effectively what the Pharisee did, isn't it? Look at verses 11 and 12. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself. You see, he wasn't really praying to God at all, was he? Just with himself. God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. He stood up to pray, and effectively he just patted himself on the back. Indeed, he congratulated God on having somebody as good as him as a friend. God, you're very lucky to have somebody like me around. There was no hint of a sense of guilt, no recognition of any weakness, just plain pride. Now, if anyone had suggested to this Pharisee that there was something wrong with him, he would no doubt have been grossly offended. He said, look, I keep the law. I pay tithes, I give money, I fast twice a week, I live a good life. What more can you want? I'm fine, I'm not guilty in any way. And yet, of course, that was not Jesus' verdict. Now, most people today, in some way, tend to reject their guilt as well, whether explicitly or implicitly. First, I suppose there's the religious, the sort of latter-day Pharisees. The one who says, well, I live a good life, I go to church, well, sometimes, not as often as I'd like, they often add, but I didn't do any harm to anybody, I try to live as good a life as I can, I'm okay, I'm not guilty. It's the sort of thing that many people say, rather like the lady who approached the 19th century preacher and said to him, Mr. Spurgeon, I haven't sinned for 3 weeks. He said, madam, you must be very proud of yourself. Oh, yes, I am, she said. Now, we may reject the idea of being guilty, but in all honesty, if we honestly face up to ourselves, we know that there is a flaw deep down in our hearts, that we're not the sort of people we should be. We're not even the sort of people that we'd like to be, that we are not perfect, and that before God we are guilty. But it's not just the religious who reject guilt, is it? It's also, I suppose you could say, the existentialist. The one who argues that there is no such thing as right and wrong. Therefore, there cannot be any guilt. I suppose Jean-Paul Sartre is one of the most formidable advocates of this. But you find many people today who'd say similar sort of things. They say there's no such thing as an absolute today. Therefore, there can be no guilt. That's what people often argue. Now, when people say that to me, I often want to punch them on the nose. Now, as I think personally, I don't wish any harm to them or to hurt them, but I want to see their reaction. Presumably they can't argue that I've done anything wrong because there is no right and wrong. But just to put your minds at rest, I've never actually done it and I don't suppose I ever will. But it's easy to argue, isn't it, that there's no such thing as right and wrong, there's no such thing as guilt, until it is we who are attacked. Until it's our house that's burgled, until it's our car that's stolen. or something like that. And we know there is a right and wrong, don't we? And we know actually in our hearts that we also are guilty. But you see, most of us don't take either of those lines, really. I think most of us tend to reject our guilt by burying it, by trying to forget it, trying to erase it from our minds. On Friday evening, I went to see the film The Nasty Girl. Some of you may have seen it. It's a fascinating story of a German girl writing an essay on her town in the time of the Third Reich. And she wanted to show how the people of that town had stood up against the Nazis. And as she asked questions, as she delved deeper, asking the people who'd been alive at the time, she found herself faced by a wall of silence and even of hostility. Skeletons, you see, were beginning to come out of the cupboard. She was beginning to uncover a guilt which had lain hidden for many years. And people didn't like it. Nobody thanked her for it. They felt that it was a guilt that was much better left buried, left hidden. And actually that's how many of us react, isn't it, to our feelings of guilt. We reject the guilt by burying it, by hoping somehow that it will never come to the surface, that nobody else will ever really find out what we're actually like. As somebody once said, if the whole truth about any of us were known, the rest of us would be shocked. It's probably true, isn't it? Deep down in our hearts, many of us know that we're guilty. Now, it may help our reputation. It may help to preserve our standing in society if nobody knows about it. But it doesn't really deal with the issue, does it? You see, if we reject our guilt, the guilt can never be dealt with. It'll always be like a festering sore underneath the surface. And what is worse, we will never know the wonder and the joy of God's forgiveness. Because we all are guilty. Well, did Mark Twain once say, the human being is the only animal that blushes and needs to. Now, we may try and reject our guilt, but if we're honest, we know that it's not true, that we are guilty. But there's a second way in which we try and handle it, and it's this. We don't reject the guilt, but we project it. In other words, we blame everybody else for it. One might almost say, actually, if Jesus were telling this story today, he may have had a third character saying just that. Saying, yes, I do things wrong. Yes, I know I'm not the sort of person that I should be, but it's not actually my fault. It's their fault, or it's his fault. It's society's fault, but it isn't mine. And the human race has been doing that sort of thing ever since the creation. Do you remember how in the Garden of Eden, when the man and the woman had eaten of the forbidden fruit, God turned to the man and said, have you eaten from the fruit of the tree that I commanded you not to? What did he say? He said, oh, it's the woman. She gave it to me. So God turns to the woman and says, oh, have you done this? And she said, well, actually, it was the serpent. He deceived me. And the story never records who the serpent blamed. But nevertheless, there is this desire very deep in all of us, isn't there, to blame somebody else for our own failings. We know it in our human families, don't we? I have numerous memories of childhood squabbles when I was always blaming my older brother and my older sister. Well, with the benefit of hindsight, I have to admit it was usually my fault. I was much the most objectionable member of the family. But as with all of us today, I hated taking the blame myself. It had to be somebody else's fault. Isn't it true in public life today, we very rarely find anybody actually taking the blame. They almost invariably try to project it onto somebody else. It's true in the field of humanities, isn't it? The human sciences. We find the same sort of thing. The fault for us being as we are is almost invariably located somewhere else. Take the field of psychology, for instance. Much is blamed on our childhood or our parents. Early influences undoubtedly mold us to a degree, but can we blame them for everything? It's amazing how so often it seems that way. Parents are either too strong or they're too weak. They're too possessive or they're too distant. They're too hard or they're too gentle. They can never get it right. They're always being blamed. But I often wonder, who do they blame? Presumably their parents. It goes on forever and ever backwards. Same is true to some extent, I suppose, in sociological studies as well, when we blame things on society, the influences of the people around us. Again, they're very strong. But it seems they're made to bear the blame and the guilt for everything. Of course, it's very attractive, isn't it? We hate being blamed for things, and if we can find somebody else to blame, we're only too happy to pass the buck. And yet the trouble is, it's ultimately unsatisfying. You see, we can have an almost perfect upbringing. We can live maybe in a perfectly good society, and yet still we have to come to terms with sin in our own hearts. And that is why so many end up disappointed and disillusioned. I believe, honestly, that's probably the Marxist error. They believe that if only you can change society, then people will work out all right. And yet the trouble is, it never seems to work like that. Some of you may have heard of a man called Professor Joad. He was a Marxist and an atheist before the Second World War. But like so many, found that that war left him utterly disillusioned. And in his disillusionment, he turned to Jesus Christ. And afterwards he said this: "It is because we rejected the doctrine of original sin that we on the left were always being disappointed. Disappointed by the refusal of people to be reasonable, by the subservience of intellect to emotion, by the behaviour of nations and politicians, by the masses' preference for Hollywood to Shakespeare, for Mr. Sinatra to Beethoven, above all by the recurrent fact of war." You see, if we blame our own sin, if we blame the state of our own hearts on somebody or something else, I fear we'll always end up disappointed. Because the problem is really nothing out there at all. The problem is in here. The heart of the human problem, as somebody once said, is the problem of the human heart. It lies in each one of us, in you and in me. What did Jesus say to us? "For from within, out of your own hearts come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, envy, slander, arrogance and folly. All of these evils come from within and make you unclean." You see, again, if we try to blame others, if we try to blame society for our own hearts, we will never get to the root of the problem. And therefore we will never be able to deal with our guilt. It may make us feel a little bit better perhaps, but we're never truly tackling the problem. You see, if on the one hand we cannot reject our guilt, equally we cannot project it onto others as well. That's the second way we deal with it. But then there's a third way, and that is to accept it. It's not to reject our guilt. It's not to project it onto somebody else. It is to accept it. That, after all, was the essential difference between these two people, wasn't it? One of them was refused to admit that he was guilty. Refused to admit that he was not good enough. But the other knew only too well his guilt. He accepted it and begged God to forgive him. I wonder if you notice those little touches there. Verse 13, the tax collector, standing far off. See, he wouldn't come near the temple. He didn't dare come near the presence of God because he knew his own unworthiness. And then when he began to pray, he didn't even lift up his eyes to heaven. He couldn't face that either. He just beat his breast saying, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." And yet it was this man who received God's forgiveness. It's this man who went home justified, forgiven, accepted. Why? Well, because he had accepted his guilt. He'd not claimed to be guiltless. He'd not tried to blame anybody else for it. He'd accepted it himself and just asked God to forgive him. You see, in this parable we have the very heart of the Christian gospel. So the Christian gospel is not that there's no problem at all. The Christian gospel is not that what problems we have is the fault of somebody or something else. The Christian gospel says that there is a deep problem in each one of us, but that God can forgive us. And all we need to do is to come in humility and ask him. Sounds ridiculous, really, doesn't it? You say, well, it can't really be that simple, that easy. But in a sense, it is that simple, yes. But easy? No. Because what it cost God was the death of his only son. See, what Jesus does not say here, but what the rest of the New Testament shows all too clearly, is how it is that God is able to forgive those who turn to him. And it is through the cross, the death of Jesus Christ alone. Jesus Christ was God, become man. And when Jesus Christ took on human flesh, when he became one of us, he did so not primarily to teach us, though he gave the greatest teaching the world has ever known. Neither was it primarily to set an example of how to live. Though, as the poet Tennyson once said, his character was more beautiful than his greatest miracle. When Jesus Christ was born, he came to die. And when Jesus died on the cross, he took all the sin, all the guilt of you and me, and paid the price for us. He took our punishment in our place. You see, as a man, he was able to stand as our representative. But as God, he was uniquely able to deal with our sin. And the amazing news of the Christian gospel is that our sin and our guilt has been dealt with by Jesus Christ on the cross. And if only we will accept that we've gone wrong, if only we will accept our guilt and ask for God's forgiveness, it is there waiting for us. You see, there is only one sort of person whom God cannot forgive. And that is the one who doesn't want forgiveness. That is the one who feels no need of it, who refused to admit his guilt. God can do nothing for that sort of person. That is why God could do nothing for that Pharisee. He thought he was okay. He thought he didn't need anything else. It may seem all too easy and too simple, and yet it is simply because of what Christ has done for us on the cross. And it is the only way to know the forgiveness that God would long for us. Now, I said at the beginning that many of us carry huge loads of guilt around with us. Sometimes that is a misplaced guilt. Sometimes if we've got nothing to feel guilty about, we actually invent something. But often, if we're honest, it is a real thing that makes us feel guilty. Real failure. And yet God still offers a new start. A fresh start. God still offers to wipe the slate clean forever. To give us complete and utter forgiveness. And that is not something we can do ourselves. We haven't got a hope. But it is something that God has made possible for us on the cross. So I just want to ask really, do you know the joy, the wonder, the freedom of sins forgiven? Do you know what it is to have that guilt dealt with deep down? You see, there is no need for any of us to go around carrying this huge burden with us. You see, if only we'd accept that we're guilty, if only we'd admit it and ask God's forgiveness, then the freedom is there for each one of us. I've known people who've experienced for the first time that forgiveness that Christ offers and say that they've had a good night's sleep for the first time in years. A burden has just rolled away. I've heard others say that it's like taking a long hot bath and suddenly knowing what it is to be clean inside. Others who've been weighed down, it seems, by years by the burden of guilt, who suddenly felt free and experienced a joy that they have never known before. I don't know if you remember that vivid picture in Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, when Christian comes to the foot of the cross, and he's been carrying a huge burden on his back, and suddenly he stands at the foot of the cross, the burden is loosed from his shoulders, and he watches it just roll down the hill. And tears pour down his cheeks as he realizes that his sins have been forgiven. And he gave three leaps for joy, and went on his way singing. It's a lovely picture of what it is, isn't it, to be freed once and for all from that burden of guilt which so many carry. Guilt is, you see, a universal human experience. And we don't solve the situation by rejecting the guilt. We don't solve it by saying, look, I'm not guilty, I'm perfectly all right, I don't need any forgiveness, I don't need any help. We don't solve it by playing the Pharisee, thinking that we're okay. Equally, we don't resolve our guilt by projecting it onto somebody else, by blaming them and saying the reason I'm as I am is because of my home or my background or society or something else. That's no help either. All we can do is accept it. Know that deep down, yes, we have gone wrong. and ask in humility for God's forgiveness through Christ. Yes, of course, afterwards Christ calls us to live a life of obedience, to be different as a result, to follow him. But it's a very small price to pay for sins forgiven and for guilt released. The story is told of a kingdom where each year the king by law was able to set one prisoner free to declare a pardon upon him. At the end of the 1 year, the king was going round his local prison and he asked the prisoners one by one in turn what reason they could give him why he should set them free. And of course they all had their reasons. Some of them said that they were not guilty of the crime for which they had been condemned. Others said that though they may have committed the crime, it wasn't their fault, it was somebody else's fault. And then finally he came to one man, he said to him, "What reason do you give me why I should let you go free?" The man said, "I have no reasons. I'm guilty as I was charged. I've been justly sentenced. I'm receiving the due punishment for what I've done." And the king said to him, "That's the man. Set him free." He was the only person, you see, who'd admit, who'd accept his guilt. And because he accepted his guilt, he knew the king's forgiveness. Now the forgiveness of sins, being freed from that burden of guilt, is rather like being let out of prison. Guilt is a prison, isn't it? It sort of ensnares so many of us. It grabs us. We can't somehow break clear of it. And yet the amazing truth is that all we need to do to accept the forgiveness of God is to accept that we've gone wrong. Is to accept our guilt and ask God's forgiveness. How is that possible? Well, there's only one way. It's through the death of Jesus Christ upon the cross. And it's simply because of that, because of what he has done, that we are able to have that clean slate, to rid ourselves of that guilty conscience, and to know full and complete forgiveness.